regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Just a reminder, tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, I'll be joining William Kirk, Washington Gun Law, on his YouTube page. We'll be talking about the wave of infringements introduced by Virginia Democrats going through all of the legislation. I'm really looking forward. I hate the topic, but I'm really looking forward to hanging out with William this evening, as well as you. And again, we'd encourage you to tune in Washington Gun Law at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, and we'll see you there. On today's program, we're going to be talking with Stephen Gutowski from The Reload about U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Janine Pirro's comments regarding concealed carry holders who may have a permit from, let's say, Virginia or Maryland, but don't have a D.C. permit. And in talking to Fox News on Monday, Pirro suggested that if you carry in D.C., without a valid DC permit, you're going to jail. In fact, what she said is if you bring a gun to the district, you're going to jail, which on its face would encompass those who possess a non-resident permit from the Metropolitan Police Department. Someone that's a description that would apply to a Steve Gutowski from The Reload as well. So let's get started with this conversation. Take a look at a list. Stephen, thanks so much for coming to the program. It's good to see you, sir.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You bet. You know those signs they have in factories? It's been X number of days since an accident. I think the Trump administration needs that for. It's been X number of days since a stupid Second Amendment comment was made. And unfortunately, we had to reset the clock yesterday because U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Janine Pirro, appearing on Fox News, talking about fighting violent crime, and then veers off into this wild tangent about concealed carry holders, right, from other states. Don't bring your gun into the district. If you bring your gun into the district, you're going to jail, she says. Which is, you know, problematic on a couple of different levels, right? So if you just look at her comments on the face, it doesn't appear to account for people like yourself who have a non-resident permit, right? You don't live in the District of Columbia, but you do have a permit issued by the Metropolitan Police Department that allows you to carry, at least in those portions of the district that are not sensitive places, right?
Which is not a lot of the district, but yes.
Okay. But even beyond that, the idea that concealed carry holders are committing a lot of crimes in the district, out-of-state permit holders are going into the district, committing a lot of crime, I mean, that just doesn't fly with me. And I submitted a request to the U.S. Attorney's Office this morning asking how many people with, you know, resident with permits from outside of the district have been arrested in the district over the past 12 months, and how many of them have been charged with a violent crime? We'll see if I even get a response, but you know, this to me is another unforced error, by an administration official, that is needlessly creating friction, among the Second Amendment community.
Yeah. I mean, as you mentioned, I think there's a couple of problems with the way that Janine Pirro was framing her comments here. One is she just directly says if you enter the district with a gun, you're going to jail. That's like straight quote from her, which is not true because you can, as you just laid out, you can be a non-resident of D.C. and get a non-resident permit, which allows you to carry a gun in the city legally. I have one. Plenty of people now can get them because of court action on this. Ren v. D.C. back in. Actually, I think it was like way back in like 2015, 2014, something like that.
Yeah, I think DC became shall issue in 2017. So I think the court case was 2016, maybe.
Yeah. So, you know, it's actually this preceded the more important landmark case of New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin. In fact, DC lost this case and then they declined to appeal because they were afraid of losing at the Supreme Court at the time, as I'm sure you and most of your audience remember how this all went down. But that made DC shall issue, which means that you could actually get a permit if you applied for one and you go through. Now, DC puts quite a lot of hoops in the way of you doing this. And somewhat interestingly, the Trump administration has actually worked to make the process of obtaining one of these permits easier. They've gotten rid of some of the kind of games that DC was playing with appointments where they'd make it so that you couldn't get an appointment until like 3 months out. And there was a bunch of stuff they were doing to delay issuing these permits that the Trump administration has come in and gotten done away with. But Pirro, for some reason, beyond like not acknowledging that you can legally bring a gun into the city, even if you don't live there, as long as you have a permit, she also frames the second part, even if you read her comments, in the most charitable light, right? And say, well, she didn't mean non-resident permits. She just meant people who don't have the DC permit are going to get locked up. She still framed it as like people who don't have the permit, but are otherwise law abiding. And I get, you know, have presumably just made a mistake and didn't understand the laws. Like, why else would somebody who has no other record carry into the city and commit no other crime than these sort of paperwork crime of not having a permit or having, not having their gun registered with the city, which is another thing you have to do in addition to getting your concealed carry permit if you want to carry legally. But, and it does, you know, on the one hand, it's sort of a snowball effect here, right? Because this is coming on the heels of what the president has been saying about gun carry and not liking Alex Pretty having a gun, despite him not breaking any of Minnesota's laws. And so now you have Pirro going after, in her own framing, otherwise law-abiding people who've and this is something that happens in D.C. People should understand, like, you and I know this as we live, you know, near the city, but there will be people who, maybe often staffers in Congress, who live outside of the city, maybe in Virginia. They have a gun legally in Virginia. They have a concealed carry weapon license in Virginia. They don't, oftentimes I think it happens because they forget perhaps that they've got their CCW on them. Mm-hmm. Maybe in their gym, they went to the gym, they put this gun in the bag, they try to enter one of the congressional staff buildings, you know, the office buildings on the Hill. And those buildings are protected kind of like airport, right? Where they've got metal detectors and they have an x-ray machine, everything you take in there that goes through security. And this happens every so often. Someone will get caught with their gun in their bag, presumably no evidence of any other intention to commit any sort of crime with the gun.
Yeah.
But because they have it and they don't live in the city, they don't have a concealed carry license, it's a crime. And you know, they get in serious legal trouble. That seems to be the exact situation that Pirro is talking about here, and it's an odd thing to emphasize as like one of your key pieces as a U.S. attorney.
Yeah,
because these are not people who are drivers of violent crime in the district by any means.
Absolutely. And I would say too, like, it's also easy to inadvertently go from Virginia to DC. If you're driving on, let's say the Ronald Reagan Parkway, mm-hmm. And you miss a turn and all of a sudden you end up on, I think it's the Key Bridge, right? And you're going into DC whether you want to or not. In fact, when I moved to Northern Virginia, the very first day I got there, I decided to do a little bit of sightseeing. I ended up on 395 in the express lanes. And I couldn't get off the express lanes until I got into D.C. I didn't want to go to D.C. that day. So, I mean, it can happen if you've got tourists, you know, who are traveling. They've got their permit that maybe is recognized in Virginia, at least for now. You know, they can also inadvertently end up in D.C. Now, this morning, Pirro did post something on X, and I want to read this here. She said, "Let me be clear. I'm a proud supporter of the Second Amendment. Washington, D.C. law requires handguns to be licensed in the district with the Metropolitan Police Department to be carried into our community. We are focused on individuals who are unlawfully carrying guns. We will continue building on that momentum to keep our communities safe." I should also mention, Steve, I don't know if you've seen this, but just a couple of minutes before you and I started chatting, she posted a video on X, a message to my fellow gun owners, "Put your safety back on." This is about a minute long. I have not had a chance to listen to it, so I will provide my commentary after we get through this interview. But, you know, I would just note that last year, Pirro came out and said, listen, if you are openly carrying a long gun in D.C. and you legally own that rifle or shotgun, we're not going to prosecute you because I believe that this D.C. law is a violation of the Second Amendment. She said, if you are a D.C. gun owner, a registered gun owner in D.C., you've got a large capacity magazine, we're not going to prosecute you because I believe that's a violation of the Second Amendment. Which begs the question. Does Pirro believe that our right to keep your arms stops at the state line? Because she clearly has looked at DC law and said, you know what? This one, I'm not going to prosecute. That one, I'm not going to prosecute. This one, she says she is going to prosecute. And I think this is only adding to the consternation and the frustration of gun owners. If she had actually had a blanket policy of, listen, I don't like the laws, but I'm going to enforce them all, Hey, there needs to be a consistent position. But she's already started picking and choosing which law she's got to prosecute. So now I think it is an open question. Why are you going to prosecute peaceful gun owners who have a license to carry in their home state, maybe in, some other states like, you know, a non-resident permit from Utah or Florida that allows you to carry in a lot of states? Why are you going to prosecute that individual simply for possessing a firearm?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does really go to what appear to be Pirro's priorities. And that's I think, the most troubling bit if you're a gun rights activist, because again, she's, as you said, I mean, and it does go to as well to sort of the inconsistency on guns that we've seen across the Trump administration, specifically in Pirro's office. As you just mentioned, she's, you know, I'm not going to prosecute you for these certain crimes, but I will make it a priority, apparently, to prosecute people who are otherwise law abiding. And either it seemingly these are people who are making a mistake. If you're not charging them with some other crime, it's hard to justify the idea that they're a real threat to society, right? Even if they did break this law, because the way she's framing it is that these are people who are otherwise law abiding. But, you know, so why make those people a priority? Why is this particular aspect of DC's very restrictive gun laws not as restrictive as they used to be because of legal action, but still among the most restrictive we have in this country for getting a permit? Is still, it's still very difficult in DC, even though it is possible, like it wasn't 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so like, why is this what you're emphasizing? Why not emphasize going after? I think it's pretty well known that the drivers of crime in places like DC, which to be fair, has seen a significant drop in crime over the last several years, as we've seen nationwide, by the way, like this, crime is not increasing in DC. I don't know why she feels this should be the priority, but regardless, like the drivers of murder in DC are not people who live in other states and have concealed carry licenses and cross the state line without understanding that they've broken the law or something like that. Like that's the person, like it'd be one thing if she just said, oh, if you're coming here to commit crimes and you're going to rob or murder people and you're from out of state, you bring a gun, I'm going to go after you. I don't think that'd be controversial at all. Right.
Absolutely.
But that's not what she said is the thing. And it's also not how she's acted. That's the other problem. Like this goes to a pattern. You know, you talked about last year during the federal takeover, if that's the right term. Obviously, DC is a federal enclave, but the influx of federal agents into the city, one of the things they emphasized was gun seizures, right? And it became a problem for at least some gun rights activists, because a lot of these crimes that they were charging people with were these types of paperwork crimes: unregistered gun, carrying without a permit, no other crime attached to it. Like, it's one thing if that's in addition to armed robbery or murder or whatever, like some sort of actual crime beyond not having the proper paperwork.
Yeah.
And that's something, as you know, that a lot of gun rights activists don't like these kinds of laws. They don't like DC's laws. They don't like the fact that you have to register your gun for it to be legal. They don't like the fact that you need a permit to carry, because that's not the case in a lot of other states. In fact, in most other states. And so to see Pirro going so hard at defending and prosecuting based on these very strict gun laws, I think gives a lot of people pause, especially when you look around and she's not doing that in the other places, like you mentioned. And then you look at the other parts of the Trump administration itself, like the Civil Rights Division, the Second Amendment section of the Civil Rights Division is, you have Harmeet Dillon out there saying that these kinds of laws are unconstitutional. She's saying you shouldn't need to have a special permit in DC to carry. So you're getting very mixed messages on this front as well. And I think that's what frustrates a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, and speaking of Harmeet Dillon, it was interesting. I ran across a video from Jeanine Pirro about a month ago where she was asked, you know, why are you prosecuting people for possessing AR-15s when the Civil Rights Division is defending the right to own these? You know, why are you enforcing DC's ban? And I hadn't seen this video before. And Pirro basically said, you know, what DOJ does is their decision. What I do is my decision. Which I, you know, had I seen this video a month ago, I would have written about that too. But you know, Costas Moros, I think, was the one who noted this last night on X. He said, you know, the Civil Rights Division is doing legitimately good work. in, you know, taking on some of these state and local gun control laws. In fact, I think today the U.S. Virgin Islands response to the DOJ's lawsuit is due to be filed. But unless you are a real hardcore Second Amendment person, unless you are a legal nerd, you're probably not aware that, you know, they're participating in oral arguments challenging Illinois' ban on so-called assault weapons. You're probably not familiar with the lawsuits that have been filed, right? The comments by Jeanine Pirro, by Scott Bessent, by Kristi Noem, by the president himself are going to get far more media attention than what the DOJ Civil Rights Division is doing in court to uphold the Second Amendment. And so, again, from a communication standpoint, this is a problem for the administration, right? You've got, this hasn't translated into policy, except perhaps maybe with Pirro's office, right? But we haven't seen President Trump, you know, call on Congress to ban possession of more than one magazine at a time, or, you know, to ban carrying a protest. We haven't seen anything like that. But still, when you get these comments back to back to back to back to back, it does, I think it endangers turnout among at least some Second Amendment supporters as you head into the midterms. At the very least, I think this is a political problem, a messaging problem for the administration that they really need to get a handle on. How do you think they could best address this beyond? Because I mean, I'll be honest, like, you know, we've seen clarifying statements. We've yet to see an official come out and say, hey, you know what? I was wrong to say that. I'm sorry. What do you think the administration could do to, you know, sort of make amends with the Second Amendment community and to demonstrate that, no, we don't think you're the problem here?
Yeah, you know, and that's a great question. And I do think there is some reason to believe, like one of my members had commented on the story we were writing about, you know, are these comments going to translate to policy? And generally speaking, that's like you said, it hasn't happened yet, and that it's probably not going to happen, is would be my guess. The last three times Trump, you know, made comments supporting new gun restrictions, the two times it didn't turn into anything. Third time is the bump stock ban, of course. Mm-hmm. So it's not impossible, but it's I would say on the whole, it's unlikely. however. You know, this is sort of one of the big risks of staffing your administration with media personalities, right? With talking heads, is that they want and crave attention. They're used to going out and saying things to get attention, and that's not always a good thing because this is what it can result in, is sort of this frayed approach to policy, or at least a frayed approach to communicating what your policy is. But there is some chance that to try and get back in the good graces of Second Amendment supporters, that they maybe go more aggressively on the program policies that they are pursuing, or pursue some more of those. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if whether it's going to happen or not. That is one possibility that you actually see as a way to kind of placate the more engaged gun rights activists, at least. Some sort of effort to do something policy wise that they want. Whether that would translate into undoing the damage from how much attention President Trump and Jeanine Pirro and these others' comments have gotten, and the impression that they've left with, you know, the average person, you know, I don't know. You could certainly have the president come out and make more comments about how much he supports the Second Amendment, but again, I don't know that undoes what you just heard. It's just like Pirro's statement this morning. I think people are used to hearing, oh, I support the Second Amendment, but you know, that's not really probably helping her cause very much to do that among the kind of people who are upset by her initial comments, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if certainly if they do, if they have real world pro-gun policy accomplishments, that will always be something that any honest person addresses, you know, assessing how the administration is performing, will have to acknowledge, right? Mm-hmm. However you feel about, you know, the president himself or these other figures, if you're looking at something and trying to objectively assess, you know, how it's going, you're going to have to acknowledge the things that they're doing in real life more than you are, generally speaking, whatever comments they make, right? Like, right. Take the guns first, have due process second is a very well-known and well-tread quote from the president from the first term, but it didn't actually turn into real-world policy in the end. And yeah. So that's more important, I think, for when you and I are trying to assess it objectively, what's going on. But, you know, people still use that quote all the time, right, to undermine Trump's claims about his support for the Second Amendment. And that will probably continue to happen with some of these quotes that you've seen over the last week from the Trump administration, regardless of how they perform on policy. But, in the end, I guess if I was giving them strategy advice, it would be put up some real world accomplishments, and people will also have to, people who are being honest about the situation will have to make that part of their assessment.
Yeah. Now, actions speak louder than words. I agree with you there. Stephen, not that, words don't matter, because you and I kind of specialize in words, but so they're important too. I would encourage folks, if you are not already subscribers to The Reload, go to thereload.com and become a subscriber. Check out the weekly Reload podcast with Steve. I'm always thankful when I get a chance to participate. Steve does great work, and Steve, always love having you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My thanks to Steve for joining us on the program. By the way, I take no joy in talking about this subject. I'm not looking for an excuse to bash the Trump administration and their Second Amendment viewpoints. Believe me, I'd prefer to talk about anything else. I prefer to talk about the accomplishments of the Trump administration and the Second Amendment. I loved having Harmeet Dhillon on this program not last month, it was December, talking about the work that the Civil Rights Division is doing. But you can't ignore these things. And by the way, I went back and I listened to the video that Jeanine Pirro posted in an attempt to do damage control. And I got to tell you, I'm not impressed. I'm not impressed. She talks about, I'm a gun owner. I own handguns. I own long guns. I'm a high-heeled gun owner. I keynoted an NRA address. Okay. What about what you said? She said in her video that the Trump administration is, pursuing those who possess guns illegally, touted the, lowest murder rate in U.S. history, which is true. But again, she didn't say anything about those individuals with permits from other states. She said, you got to follow the law. She said, if you're a gun owner, you got to know what the gun registration laws are. Personally, as a Second Amendment supporter, I believe that gun registration laws are unconstitutional. But if we want to talk about knowing what the law is, well, again, Jeanine Pirro stated that the D.C. statute that bans the open carry of long guns, in her view, is unconstitutional. She wasn't going to prosecute that. Jeanine Pirro stated that D.C.'s ban on, quote-unquote, large-capacity magazines is unconstitutional in her view, so she's not going to prosecute that for D.C. residents. So it's one thing for Jeanine Pirro to say, we got to know what the law is. Okay, but your office is deciding not to enforce some of these laws. And if you're taking that step, if you're saying, hey, I think this law is unconstitutional, well, I got to tell you, Madam U.S. Attorney, that opens you up to questions about, well, why do you think this law is constitutional? So if you think large capacity magazine bans are unconstitutional, you're not going to enforce those. You think bans on open carrying long guns is unconstitutional, you're not going to enforce those. Do you believe that gun registration laws are constitutional, since you're going to enforce that statute? Do you believe that the right to keep and bear arms turns into a privilege once you leave the borders of the state where you live, since you are going to prosecute people with valid concealed carry permits from Virginia, Maryland, any other state who happen to be in Washington, D.C., not charged with a violent crime, just charged with possessing a firearm, an unregistered firearm, without a valid D.C. license? Again, if you've taken the step of saying, I'm not going to enforce statutes X and Y because I think they're unconstitutional, you will get asked, why are you enforcing statute Z? And I got to tell you, again, I take no pleasure in saying this. Not impressed with the answer so far from Jeanine Pirro. I'm just not. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Georgia. Slaying wounded officer remembered for gentle spirit. Suspect's long criminal history emerges This was a officer-involved shooting over the weekend. One Gwinnett County police officer killed, another critically injured. Officer Pradeep Tamang, who came to America from Nepal 10 years ago, had been with the Gwinnett Police Department less than a year, died at the hospital over the weekend. Master Police Officer David Reed, shot and critically injured. The pair were investigating a fraud complaint at a motel or a hotel on Sunday morning when 35-year-old Kevin Andrews allegedly opened fire without warning, according to police. And Andrews, as it turns out, has quite the criminal history. Again, 35. He's been arrested 22 times since 2009, starting with allegedly bringing a gun to a high school. He currently has 3 open cases in DeKalb County, including trafficking more than 400 grams of methamphetamine. Judges granted bond in all 3 of those cases over the objections of prosecutors before Andrews missed a 2024 court appearance in April. A 2022 indictment charged Andrews with aggravated assault after allegedly shooting at a woman. And again, what kind of consequences did Andrews face in these crimes? 22 arrests since 2009. I don't know how many convictions he's had since then, but he has been accused of several violent crimes. And even with the plethora of open cases against him, judges keep putting him out on the street. Now, I imagine in this case, now that he's accused of murdering a police officer, he'll be held without bond. But you shouldn't, it shouldn't take committing a front page crime or a crime that leads the nightly news before somebody's criminal history is taken into account and a judge says, oh, you know what, maybe you are a danger to the community. And again, I'm not one of those people who believes everybody charged with a crime should remain in jail until trial. It's not workable. It's not constitutional. But when you legitimately pose a threat to the community, based on prior convictions, based on the severity of the charge against you at the time, when there is a reasonable belief, let's say, that you pose a threat to the community, or that you're you pose a reasonable risk of flight, right? That you're not going to show up because you're going to flee the area. Bond is appropriate in those circumstances. And I would say in this case, the seriousness of the charges that Andrews is already facing should have been enough again to hold him until trial, instead of putting him out back out on the streets where he is now again accused of shooting 2 police officers, killing one of them over the weekend. Today's Armed Citizen story from Alabama, where a woman was found not guilty in a 2022 killing of a barber at a Birmingham apartment complex. The defendant in this case was charged, went to trial. A jury acquitted her, saying that she acted in self-defense. Sabrina Andrews is now 23. She was charged with a capital murder in the death of 23-year-old Keandra Rashun Kiki Hollis. Her trial began last Tuesday in Jefferson County, ended on Friday afternoon with a verdict of not guilty. AL.com says that Andrews' attorneys, Emery Anthony and Moses Stone, successfully argued that their client shot Hollis in self-defense. Anthony said, it's a sad situation that occurred. It should not have occurred, but it did. So when officers were dispatched to the 300 block of Martin Luther King Jr. Drive in 2022, they found several citizens who were telling them that a woman had been shot, was taken by a private vehicle to a local hospital. They went to check that local hospital to find out the status of Hollis. The hospital was actually having her transferred to another facility, but Hollis passed away before that move took place. Police said at the time that there had been a verbal altercation between multiple people throughout the day. That's what led to the shooting. Andrews' attorney said it was self-defense because Hollis was the one who actually showed up where Andrews lived and was aggressive. Hollis, one of 8 children, avid basketball player, became a barber about a year before her death. AL.com doesn't get into the details of the self-defense argument, but those facts must have been pretty compelling if prosecutors were unable to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Andrews, in fact, committed murder. And maybe the fact that, you know, the fact that Hollis showed up at Andrews' home alone does not make that a justifiable shooting. If somebody comes up to your door and knocks and they're polite, you don't have a reasonable belief that your life's in danger. You can't shoot that person. we've seen this a couple of times in not too distant past, right? So there must have been some other action on the part of Hollis that presented a legitimate threat to Ms. Andrews, where Ms. Andrews, again, was justified, had a reasonable belief that her life was in danger. Wish we had more information. I'll see if I can find out any more information about this case. But again, Sabrina Andrews, charged with capital murder, acquitted by a jury who found she acted in self-defense there in Birmingham, Alabama. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Saw this a post on X earlier today by my buddy Terry Shepard. And I wanted to share this with you. Terry is a good guy. Got to know Terry back in the NRA News Cam and Company days, and have had the opportunity to spend some time with Terry, to break bread with Terry. I knew he was a good guy before I saw this post. I know that's hard to read there on the screen, so I'm going to share it with you. But Terry lives down in the Outer Banks, and he says, we had a pretty impressive snowstorm this weekend. So there's a wheelchair-bound elderly lady in town with an outside elevator and an inside stair lift, and both of them were broken before the storm got here. So he said, Outer Banks dog walker and I started going to her place as the storm was hitting. And we kept going back to make sure that she was okay and to walk her service dog, Tegan. Tegan was a bomb-sniffing dog who got wounded in Afghanistan. He was taken offline and then thankfully trained to be her service animal. Terry said he's a huge 10-year-old boy who's very protective of her. He said, I was warned that he was scary, but when I first met him, he walked right up to me, leaned his body into mine, instant friends. In the picture that he shared the Sunday after the storm, he said, Tegan, and he walked to the beach, said, I got a kiss. He said, I feel like we have an understanding. Two old combat veterans looking out for each other. He's going to be seeing a lot of me, says Terry. God is good. And, you know, on the surface, I realize this post is about Terry and Tegan. But really, it's about Terry and OBX dog walker and Tegan and Tegan's owner, right? Terry takes in senior dogs. That's as long as I've known him, that's what he does. He takes dogs, shelter dogs, who are, you know, senior, and he gives them a good life in the years that they have left. That alone, I think, is commendable. But, you know, I know Terry loves dogs, but Terry loves people too. And looking out for Tegan, making sure he gets his walk in, that's great. But the reason why he's doing that is to alleviate that concern and to help out this elderly lady stuck in a wheelchair, without a working elevator, without a stair lift. And I'm pretty sure that, although Terry didn't talk about this in his ex post, that Terry provided some more help for that woman as well. So in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a good man, Terry Shepard, and we thank him for his very good deed. All right, that has got to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Again, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, Washington Gun Law. Be sure to check it out with William Kirk and myself tonight, talking about the onslaught of infringements in Virginia. Coming up on tomorrow's Bearing Arms Cam and Company, we're going to be talking with Daniel Schmutter, Second Amendment attorney in New Jersey. We'll talk about the amicus brief that Dan filed in the Hamani case, which is slated for oral arguments before the Supreme Court here in about a month. Actually, I think a month from today, March 3rd. So we'll be talking about that as well. And of course, be sure to check out BearingArms.com today. We're keeping you up to date on all the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, we'd encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. No matter what tier support you choose, you'll be supporting the work that we're doing. We're very grateful for that. So thank you again. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow, if not tonight, on YouTube. And in the meantime, be well, be safe, and be free.